All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. At the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to an interview that Cornel West did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. It's in October of 2012, and I'm doing this to sort of give people an idea about what it's going to be like, only magnify it by 100 times, with this dialogue that's happening on November 15th in New York City at the Riverside Church between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. It's called Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian, live and in person. All right, so check this out. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show Carl Dix. And Carl Dix is a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party. He is also a founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Carl, along with Cornel West and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, have called for a month of resistance, okay, a month of resistance to mass incarceration, police terror, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. And Teddy, I want to play that first cut there to give people a sense of what this is about, and we'll welcome Carl in, all right?
No longer will we stand by while millions and millions of people are subjected to mass incarceration, police terror, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. What kind of society do you want to live in? This October will mark the month of resistance to mass incarceration, police terror, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. We refuse to live in a country where police brutality and police murder are daily occurrences. Yet brutal murdering cops are almost never punished for their crimes. Murdering people, young black and Latino people are treated like criminals, guilty until proven innocent. If they can survive to prove their innocence. This criminalization has led to 2.2 million people being warehoused in prison, a 500% increase over the past 30 years. Tens of thousands of people in prison are subjected to the torture of long-term solitary confinement. Alongside this has risen a program of criminalizing and incarcerating undocumented immigrants, where the color of a person's skin determines whether they live and how they live. To act to stop these horrors, we pledge to engage in mass determined resistance. No longer will we suffer these abuses in silence or stand by while they are inflicted on others. We will reach out to others and call on them to join us, rallying an increasingly powerful movement of resistance until mass incarceration, police terror, and the criminalization of the youth are no more. This October, we will make good on this pledge in many different ways in every avenue of society. Urge you to join us. What will you do? I'm Chuck D, Public Enemy Number One.
All right, that was Chuck D, Public Enemy Number One, reading the Pledge of Resistance in connection with the October month of resistance to mass incarceration, police terror, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. And joining us to talk about this is Carl Dix. Carl, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Michael, and thank you for having me on.
Yeah, definitely, man. Let's talk about this. Chuck D laid out a pretty powerful message there, and this was the Pledge of Resistance. Can you tell us a little bit about this Pledge of Resistance and what it's all about?
Well, the Pledge of Resistance is something that we developed in the lead-up to the October month of resistance, and we felt like we needed a short, sharp delineation of the horrors of mass incarceration, police terror, and the criminalization of the youth, and a pledge for people to stand up and act to stop it, and focusing on taking a big leap and doing that in October. And we came up with it, we disseminated it with a plan of people taking the pledge to resist on October 1st. And the effort to do this was given a big boost when Chuck D decided to record it and make his recording available to help kick off the month. The pledge was taken in cities across the country. People gathered in Ferguson, Missouri, to take the pledge on October 1st. There were several gatherings in New York City where people took the pledge. A couple in Los Angeles, in the San Francisco Bay Area, in Chicago, in Jacksonville, Florida, and a number of other cities. So we feel like October got off to a strong start, and now we face the task of continuing and building off of the momentum from the readings of the pledge on the 1st.
Well, one of the things that the Stop Mass Incarceration Network has brought out, and also that some research has been done by the RevCom.us website, by Revolution Newspaper and the RevCom.us website, it was stunning. I mean, for people who might be sitting back and thinking, okay, for whatever reason, they might be sitting back and thinking, okay, you know, we've heard this, we know this, what are we going to do, what are we going to do? There was something really that stunned me, and I'm hardly somebody who isn't keenly aware of what's going on, but the whole idea that there's a war against black and brown people and that there's a genocidal assault going on was really driven home when I looked at the way that there's actually some concrete statistics that show, or some concrete examples that show, in 1 month, what was it, 60 people were killed by the police just recently?
Yes, between July 17th, the day that Eric Garner was choked to death by police on Staten Island, and August 17th, in that 1 month period, 60 people were killed by the police. And this is based upon the research that Revolution Newspaper and the RevCom website did. So there may have been more than that that they were unable to find out about. But 60 people, about two people each and every day, were killed in just that 1 month period. And it was not a matter of, well, the police were in shootouts with dangerous criminals. They were mostly people who were unarmed. Many people who were doing nothing illegal or even suspected illegal, but they were killed by police. And this is the reality that is especially targeting black and brown people. And when cops kill in this way, they are almost never punished. And we see this in the high-profile cases. It is even more the case in the cases that go under the radar because, you know, it's still the case. Michael Brown, going on 2 months ago, killed in a very heinous manner, gunned down, hands up, eyewitnesses to it, audio recordings of it, still no cop has been charged. The same thing with Eric Garner, who was killed almost a month before Michael Brown. This is the way it goes. Cops routinely brutalize and even murder people and get off with no punishment. This is part of what we're up against. We could go to the aspect of incarceration and the vicious brutality and even torture that's inflicted on people there, and the fact that almost never do the jail guards who inflict this brutality and torture get punished for it. All of this underscores the need for a month of resistance to mass incarceration, to take the level of resistance to a much higher level. And also, the times right now point to the possibility to make a big leap, to tap into people's growing awareness of these horrors, their questioning of, why is this happening, and what can be done about it? And we're coming forward very strongly with the message that it is up to us to act to stop it.
Let me ask you this, Carl.
Go ahead.
Part of this is, and I think it's really important, because you're talking about a month of resistance, and that flies in the face of a lot of what's being pumped out to people all over the place. And we saw it. It came to a head in Ferguson, where there were really two very sharply and clearly delineated positions. And this whole idea of somehow let the system work. Eric Holder, he came down, he stepped in and straightened some stuff out. They're going to go up against these Yahoo Barney Fife on steroid cops in Ferguson. They're going to do this. They're going to do that. We got to talk to people. We got to have some conversation about race and federal investigations. And in opposition to that, you say we need resistance. Let's talk a little bit about those two poles out there.
Yeah, this is a very important question, because when people say let the system work, they are putting that out either in ignorance on their own part or hoping that the people that they're saying it to don't know that the system has been and still is working, because that is the way it goes. The frontline enforcers, the cops, are given a green light to brutalize and murder, and when they do it, the entire system backs them up in it. The courts almost never prosecute them. In the few times that they do get prosecuted, the prosecutors who are expert at getting black and Latino youth into prison, sometimes even on just trumped up charges and stuff like that, seem to forget how to prosecute. So killer cops and racist vigilantes almost always get off with their crimes. And even the Justice Department, which is now being touted as, well, this is what you should rely on, it is actually a regular thing that when killer cops don't get charged or get let off, the Justice Department enters the case and opens up an investigation. And they investigate for months, sometimes for a year, sometimes for a couple years, and then come back with no basis to bring a federal case. I mean, I've worked with a number of parents of police murder victims who have been taken through that dance. Wait for the locals to take care of it. And when they don't take care of it, the Department of Justice lets them know that they're going to open up an investigation, and then a year or so later they hear that there's no basis for the feds to do anything about it. And I can take you through people who have been taken through that dance, and it's just a way to keep people looking within the framework of a system that is operating and actually functioning to carry out a slow genocide against Black and Latino people and to corral and rope back in people's anger in the face of this. And right now it's very important that the path of standing up and resisting be out there and be put before people, because right now it's right on the front burner for society. It can no longer be said that this does not happen, and it's happening with such great frequency that it is very hard to say that it's an isolated incident. And people really should go to the website revcom.us, because the research that we were talking about 60 people killed by the police in a month's period, was something that was done by researchers and reporters for Revolution Newspaper. That's available at RevCom, the website revcom.us. And people who want to know what's happening with the Month of Resistance and want to get involved and plugged in should go to the website stopmassincarceration.net.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're talking about the October Month of Resistance to Mass Incarceration, Police Terror, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation. All right, let me ask you this, Carl. One of the things that you talk about within this month, and there's a couple things I want to touch on. First this, and then we'll talk about students and the involvement of campuses and whatnot, which I thought was very exciting and important in terms of making some bigger breakthroughs. But one of the things that you talk about is that there's been a call issued, and I think the call has been issued by Hands Up United, Organization for Black Struggle, and a coalition of local and national organizations demanding justice for Mike Brown in Ferguson. And there's been a call issued for people to come to Ferguson. And you talk about that, urging people to get down there. And it's in the context of saying that, and it's related to everything you've just been saying, but the stakes around this now, this is one of those moments where the stakes are really high. Can we talk about that?
Yes, I mean, we felt that it was very important when the call was issued for a weekend in Ferguson, October, the weekend of October 10th to the 13th, and that people are continuing to stand up in Ferguson. And when we heard that call was issued, Revolution Newspaper very quickly began to spread that call. The Steering Committee for the Month of Resistance to Mass Incarceration, Police Terror, Oppression, the Criminalization of a Generation officially endorsed that call and began to mobilize to bring a delegation of activists from all around the country to be down in Ferguson standing with people, because there is a real fight for justice that needs to be carried through, and that fight needs to be linked up to nationwide resistance against the horrors of police murder, mass incarceration, and all its consequences. Because this is a time, and that case kind of has concentrated some of these horrors, and this battle must be continued and must be built strong, more strength, and tied in more with the nationwide movement of resistance. So we felt that that was very important to do. The delegation from the Month of Resistance is going to bring down Stolen Lives banners that have the names of people murdered by the police in cities around the country, because people need to see the breadth of what we're up against, and that this isn't something that we can sit back and let the system work on, because it's been working on it for decades. but also they need to see that there are those who stand with them in this fight. And those two things are things that we want to bring by supporting, taking up, and being down in Ferguson for that weekend. And Cornel West, my co-issuer of the call for the month of resistance, has told me that this is going to be another chance for him and me to share a jail cell, because civil disobedience is going to be part of the plan for Monday.
Again, it really does speak to even saying that. People got to understand that actually it's not a walk in the park getting arrested for civil disobedience in relation to this now.
No, it's not.
But the fact is, I mean, not even, it's not anything for people to take lightly, because the stakes are just that high. What I've been reading in the newspaper alone, both in Revolution newspaper, but broadly in all these various newspapers, the kind of coverage that people get, even the idea that a jury convicted that guy, that racist that murdered Jordan Davis down in Florida, they convicted him of murder, right? And there's certain things that are being pushed to try and ease up the contradiction a little bit, but at the same time, they're faced with a real necessity. You know, look, the black and Latino youth, black and Latino people in general, the idea of what's posed in terms of these people and the role that they can play in society and the contradictions that they face and how they can break through a lot of things and push things in the direction that they need to go in terms of actually if you're looking to end this thing once and for all. And knowing that this is going on, this kind of the arresting people who are leading these various things, this is something people have to take seriously. I was very impressed with what was happening on the campuses. I was very impressed when I saw some of the stuff that's developed in the wake of the Mike Brown thing, but generally around this kind of the need to resist. Can we talk a little bit about the scene on the campuses today? Because that's another very important element of this whole picture.
A very important arena that we wanted to help accelerate resistance to mass incarceration and police terror in. And there have been some really positive responses to those efforts. There are 8 campuses in the Northeast, including some Ivy League schools, that are doing a weekend around torture in prison, building mock solitary confinement cells. And they include a couple of Ivy League schools, Princeton, I'm forgetting the names of some of them, but there are 8 of them now, and it started out with, I think, 5, so the numbers are growing. There are symposiums planned during the first full week of October that include events on Columbia's campus and at UC Berkeley, where there are going to be voices gathering together to condemn the horrors of mass incarceration, police terror, and call on the students and others to join the resistance. And this is going to include some of the people who have directly experienced this, like family members of police murder victims, people whose relatives are now held in prison, including at least one whose relative is being held under long-term solitary confinement, and formerly incarcerated people.
All right, Carl, we have time for one last question, and I wanted to pose this. I mean, I keep looking at all these things and thinking about the stakes question that you were talking about, and even I remember being so outraged when I read this earlier, and the whole idea, it gives you a sense of how sharp things are in Ferguson, but in the country as a whole, with this point about the Ferguson police wearing the I Am Darren Wilson bracelets, Darren Wilson being the cop that murdered Mike Brown. And that kind of shows you the kind of what's lining up in society in a certain sense. I think it's really important that people understand that this month of resistance can play a whole role in moving things to a whole different level in terms of the polarization in society in a good way. And I wanted you to tell people about some of the ideas, just right on, if you can run down what people are talking about, and then we'll wrap it up, all right?
Okay, this is a very important example that you're pointing out, these police officers wearing those armbands, because what are you saying when you identify with a cop who killed a black teenager who had his hands up? You're saying that I stand for brutality and murder and the subjugation of this whole people in this society. And that's what we're up against, and that's what this is about. And people are acting to take this on. There are going to be coordinated demonstrations nationwide on October 22nd. And in New York City, people have taken the approach of no business as usual, no work, no school, be in the streets on this day. There are going to be cultural events happening in cities across the country. It's a campaign of sermons in churches, mosques, and synagogues condemning the horrors of mass incarceration and police terror. Flash mobs are going to occur. People are going to be acting in a lot of different ways. And then throughout the month, we're going to be promoting people wearing orange in solidarity with the resistance movement to mass incarceration. So the point is to gather tens of thousands of people from different backgrounds to stand together and say no more to these horrors. And through that, to put up a big stop sign right in the face of U.S. society to mass incarceration and police terror and impact and move millions of other people to let them know that there's a growing, determined section of people fighting to stop these horrors, because we don't stand for, well, let's reduce them, let's ease these problems a little bit. They need to be stopped, and we want to impact millions around that and move some of them to join in the resistance.
All right, Carl Dix, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on, Michael. And again, go to the website stopmassincarceration.net to find out about and get involved in this month, and the website revcom.us to find out a lot of information about what's going on around this and many other developments around the country and around the world.
All right, Carl, take care, man. Thank you. All right, we've just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we've been talking about the October month of resistance against mass incarceration, police terror, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be listening to an interview that Cornel West did with Bob Avakian back in October of 2012. Stay tuned.
We need to see a revolution in America!
Welcome back. That was Dance of the Revolution by Conspiracy of Thought. All right, that's a really powerful song. And I felt that that was actually kind of the thing that we needed to open up this segment of the show. Now, for a while, I've been letting you know about this new dialogue that's going to be happening on November 15th, 2014 at Riverside Church in New York City. All right, and it's a dialogue. The title of the dialogue is Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian, live and in person. This is going to be an historic event, all right? It has the potential to really change the whole terms of things in society, how we look at the world, at the horror of the world, and how we look at why we say it doesn't have to be this way, and what's that mean, and how we're going to go about changing that. This is a dialogue that can really open up a whole nother level of discussion and discourse in society, a serious discussion about how the hell to get out from under all this, all right? And I want to play for you an interview that Cornel West did with Bob Avakian back in October of 2012. And it's an interview that was done on the Smiley and West radio show when they did have a Smiley and West radio show. So check this out.
We are joined this week with my dear brother, Bob Avakian. He is the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. He is a legendary freedom fighter. He's a long-distance runner. He's one of the few coming out of the 60s who never sold out. He never caved in. He never gave up. Held on to his forging of a rigorous scientific analysis of the objective realities that are driven by a revolutionary love, because he has such a deep love for poor people, oppressed people all around the world. And whether you agree or disagree with our brother, one thing you cannot deny, that he is the real thing. No doubt about it. Brothers, the blessing to have you. Say hello to the audience.
Hello, and thank you very much for that introduction.
No, I'm just telling the truth. So just quickly, let's begin with your reading of our historical moment.
Well, you talked about some of it. I mean, even recent history with the Japanese, the concentration camps and turned Japanese, and today the mass incarceration of youth from the inner cities, of black and brown youth in particular, the little talked about phenomenon of like masses of women in the inner cities being evicted. There's a lot of talk also about people being foreclosed in their homes, but poor women being evicted in growing numbers, as well as growing numbers of poor women going into prison, as the United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world in general and of women in particular. Then there are the wars, there's the poverty, there's the economic crisis. You know, and we could go, and the repression in general, we could go on and on. This is the kind of world we're faced with, where, for example, 10 million children die every year in the third world of malnutrition and preventable disease. 10 million children every year, more than the population of the biggest city in the United States, for example. And this is the reality that we're dealing with. And the reality is not only that this is horrific, but that it's totally unnecessary. We live in a world of tremendous abundance, but what we have is the private appropriation by a few of this great wealth that's produced by many, and it doesn't go to the benefit of the many. So we need a revolution to radically change this society, but not just this society, the whole world. And we have to change, in fact, the way in which this society, as much as it oppresses people here, the ruling class of the society feasts off the rest of the world and enriches itself on that basis under even worse conditions than what the worst face here. So this is where we stand, and there, you know, we're up against powerful forces, people that rule this country. I mean, anybody who doesn't recognize how powerful they are doesn't deserve to be taken seriously. Let's just say that straight up. But they're also sitting on top of a system that's erupting underneath them, a system that's riddled with contradictions economically. Politically, they claim that there's liberty and justice for all, but we know that's not true. We know there's profound and widespread injustice. And these contradictions are the basis for how a movement to actually rid humanity of this system can be built.
No, indeed. As you know, I've had a wonderful conversation with Brother Carl Dix.
Right.
Just calling for stop and frisk, Brother Carl Thorne down, and Brother
Leonard Sassani.
Oh, Lord, yes. I mean, one distinctive feature of revolutionary communists in the party that you are head of, founder of, is that they tend to accent white supremacy. They tend to accent poor people and their dignity, capacity to change things, but also a scientific analysis of what they are up against. Now, could you tell us just very briefly your conception of revolution vis-a-vis, let's say, Martin Luther King, who called for revolution, wanted a transfer of power from oligarchs to everyday people, recognizing the horror, the misery, the nightmare. But this is important for me, of course, because I'm a revolutionary Christian, you're a revolutionary communist. Could you give us the difference in your understanding?
Yeah, well, let me just add first before I get into that, let's not forget also, and I know you don't, about male supremacy.
And
of the great horrors in this world today is the, you know, enslavement of young girls and women in the millions all over the world, including right in this country and right down the street from wherever people are in sexual slavery, as well as other horrific forms of oppression of women and gay people and others in this society, just to get the whole picture, flesh it out, and I know you agree with me on that. But to speak to the difference in essence is, first of all, Martin Luther King called for a nonviolent change. Or the revolution that when he used the word revolution, it was an idea of change that would come about within the existing framework, even if it meant radical change. But what we're talking about is actually breaking the hold of those who rule the society and who prey on the masses of people here and around the world, breaking the hold of their institutions of violent repression over the masses of people. Now, we're not talking about running out and being crazy and trying to do this when there's not a basis for it. In order to have a revolution, you have to have millions and ultimately tens of millions of people who are convinced of the need for that revolution, who are not only fed up and don't want to live another day in this kind of way, but are convinced that there's a radically different way that they could live and that human beings could interrelate and the society and the world could be. And when you get to that point, which is what we're working to bring into being, that kind of consciousness and that kind of political movement and resistance against the crimes of this system, when you get to that point, then you have to be able to deal with the fact that violent repression is going to be brought down on you. These people are not going to step aside. They're not going to say, oh, you're right. You know, we've committed horrible crimes all around the world. We've done terrible things to people. We're going to stop and step aside so you can build a better world. No, they're going to try to violently crush any organized force and broader mass of people who are trying to bring about that change. And you're going to have to deal with their attempts to violently crush it. You're going to have to defeat that. You're going to have to defeat their institutions and their organs of violent repression against people, and you're going to have to dismantle them and replace them with revolutionary institutions that actually serve the radicalization of society in the interests of the great majority of people. in the world, and ultimately serving the emancipation of humanity as a whole from this whole horror that we've been living under.
You know, we just had the first debate, and it was a sad spectacle to see the two candidates unable to really engage any of the real issues affecting poor people and working people. Why do you think American society, American culture has been so resistant to the kind of awakening that would lead poor and working people to straighten their backs up, organize, and engage in forms of social activism and resistance that would fundamentally change a society?
Well, I think the people that are vying to be the chief executive and commander-in-chief of this system and its armed forces are trying to enforce the very system and maintain by force the very system that causes all the things that you were just mentioning, and that people need to be organized to stand up against, resist, fight against, and eventually get rid of through revolution. So I think that explains why they talk the way they do and about what they talk about, because their interests are completely different from, and not just different, they're completely opposed to the interests of the great majority of people in this society, and especially those they have their boot on most viciously. So that's one thing. I also wanted to go back, though, not to miss an important element of the previous question you asked, sort of, if you will, the philosophical dimension. What's the difference between a Christian revolutionary and a communist revolutionary?
Yeah.
I know that we want to talk about that. You know, and the difference is that communism proceeds on a scientific basis of actually probing, investigating, and summing up what's learned from reality, and then testing what conclusions you draw from that against reality, so that we can proceed from what is actually arises in reality and what can be verified in reality. And that's our, you know, that's our basic scientific approach. My belief in revolution and our party's firm foundation and the principles of making revolution is not grounded in the idea that, well, it would just be morally right, although we're profoundly convinced it is morally right, or not just that it would be nicer if the world could be this way, but actually a concrete analysis which leads us to understand in the full dimensions what a horror the world is for the great majority of humanity. If you just think about those 10 million children in the third world as just one, you know, concentration of that, what a horror it is, but on the other hand, that it does not have to be this way. And so that we don't base it on, you know, what you've referred to as a prophetic tradition or, you know, religious belief. We base it on a scientific belief, even though it also includes an ethical or moral dimension, that we don't just understand the world as a horror. We also feel that it's intolerable, but we also ground that in a scientific understanding that it does not have to be this way. And the more that you understand scientifically that it does not have to be this way, the more outraged you are by the fact that it continues to be this way and that there are forces who insist upon and use violence to maintain this system, and with all the consequences that means for the great majority of people.
No, indeed, indeed, because I know the audience is titillated to have such a revolutionary atheist with a revolutionary Christian and still have overlap in terms of our love for poor people, and not only that, but a willingness, both of us, to live and die for the cause of trying to change the world in the interest of oppressed people, of those friends for known call the wretched of the earth. But it's so difficult to adjudicate the atheism and the God talk, in the sense of that, will there ever be a kind of final agreement between us? Well, that's difficult to envision, because it looks like I'm so rooted in my own understanding of the prophetic tradition and rooted in my own conception of God's love that leads me to want to live and die for poor folk. And yet your life has been exemplary in willingness to pay cost and price and persist and prevail in trying to disclose certain truths objectively and still sustain what I call a revolutionary love for poor people. Is that a fair characterization when I say you have a revolutionary love for poor people?
Well, I think that's part of it, definitely. If you don't have those kind of, you know, if you don't have those kind of feelings, just put it simply, then you cannot be a revolutionary, you cannot be a communist. If you're not outraged at what poor people and people broadly in the world are put through, you know, if that doesn't cause your blood to boil, to put it that way, then you could never be a revolutionary. So in that sense, definitely yes. And if you don't burn with a desire to put an end to that and bring something much better into being, especially when you see that it's possible, then you have absolutely no right to talk about being a revolutionary.
See, that's the kind of fire I'm talking about, and I love that fire. You go back to Black Panther Party. You go back to working with the early Huey Newton. You go back to working with the Revolutionary Union in the Bay Area. You have a long, long, rich history, and yet you've been able to sustain it, to keep alive both your hope as well as your imagination, scientific analysis, that wonderful core with a lot of elasticity, that heart that still has a flexibility, as it were. How do you account for Brother Bob Ovakian still being part of this revolutionary love train?
Well, we were talking about this before. If you see the world the way it is, and you draw the conclusion you have to draw from being willing to look straight face at the world the way it is, and you recognize that it has not gotten better for the great majority of humanity, it continues to get worse. You know, people are uprooted from one place and desperately searching all over the earth for a way to make a livelihood, trying to go from one country to another just in order to live. You know, they're subjected to wars, they're subjected to environmental destruction, they're subjected to the horror of their own kids being shot down on the street by the police in the hundreds every year in this country. You know, if you see all that, then, and you know that it doesn't have to be that way. Look at all the abundance there is in the world. It's been, the technology, the interconnectedness of people, which could lead to a rich life, and I don't mean financially.
Right.
I mean in what you would call spiritual sense.
Yes,
I mean
yes.
In the enrichment of life, the quality of people's lives. You know, both their material needs, but their intellectual and cultural needs could be met on a whole other level, and yet they're being suffocated and strangled under this system. Why would you want to live under this any longer? Why would you not want to keep working and struggling? And yes, why would you not have an open mind to learn from anyone and anything you could learn from in order to be able to fight better to do this? That's the bedrock of everything. That's where I live, if you want to put it that way, because I've seen the horror, and I've also seen the fact that it doesn't have to be this way. There have been previous, great breakthroughs that are made in Soviet Union and China to build a whole new socialist society, to be on the road of doing away with these things, and they were turned back and defeated. So we've had to study very deeply the lessons to learn how to do better, and both in fighting, but also in when we get to the stage where we have a new society, how to actually lead that society in an even better way so we can stay on the road and defeat the attempts to crush what we brought into being. So all that goes into it. Why would you want to settle for anything less once you see on the one hand what the horror is, but also on the other hand, what the possibility for something much different and truly beautiful really is?
I think Americans oftentimes overlook the degree to which communists in our past, though not in any way a large majority, there's always been a small minority of communists in America, but they've played a very important role in struggles against injustice, struggles against white supremacy, male supremacy, struggles against capitalism, struggles against homophobia. We think in the civil rights movement, there are a number of communists that played an important role, going back to the trade union movement. What is the role of revolutionary communists at this particular moment, the kind of an Occupy moment, even though the Occupy movement needs to bounce back? What is the role of communists, and how will revolutionary communists attempt to provide some kind of vision and analysis?
Well, we have a slogan that sort of encapsulates how we approach building a movement for revolution, which is fight the power and transform the people for revolution. And all three parts of that are important. First of all, if people don't rise up against their oppression, if they're just beaten down continually, then they're never going to be able to actually bring a new world into being, and they're never going to be able even to think about the big questions that we're discussing right here of could the world be a different way? Why is it the way it is, and is there a possibility for it to be radically different and better? So people need to be led, and they need to rise up and fight back against the many ways in which people are oppressed, and we need to unite with people when they do rise up. And we need to, at the same time, when we get to transform the people, that means transform the thinking, the consciousness of the people, so they see not just the need to resist this or that outrage, but they see the interconnection of all these different things that outrage people and people rise up against, and they see how they're all rooted in the same capitalist imperialist system and the way that it works and the way that it has to work and the way that it crushes people in working the way it does. And they begin to see, at the same time, the possibility of a radically different world, because they come to understand that while the system works this way, there is a basis for a whole different kind of system that works on different bases that put the interests of the people forefront and fundamentally, you know, as the basis for what people are doing. So that's transforming the people. It's transforming their thinking, transforming how they relate to each other, transforming what they think is possible, raising their heads so that they can think about the things that normally they're pushed down from even being able to think about. And then for what? For revolution, because if people don't rise up and fight back, they'll be crushed. But if they just rise up and continually and fight back, they're going to be still trapped in the same situation they're in. I mean, you know, I've said this before. If I were a preacher, you know, and I were looking at all the things going on in the world, you know, just how many times you have to read about another family whose, you know, whose son or daughter is shot down by the police, and all the tears that flow and the anguish that flows on the basis of that. How many times do you have a Romarly Graham or a Manuel Diaz out in California or a Sean Bell or Oscar Grant? How many times do you have that go on? You know, and I don't want to be here, you know, or have someone else be here 30 years from now talking about what we're going to do about the fact that police are shooting people down on the streets in the hundreds every year and subjecting millions of youth to mass incarceration, or women to mass enslavement, or denying them the right to abortion or birth control. I don't want to see a world in which 30 or 40 years from now, we're going over the same outrages talking about what are we going to do about it. We need to move beyond that, so we need a revolution to get to where we can move beyond it.
One of the fascinating features of the Revolutionary Communist Party is the stress on the arts, music, and on poetry. You've written quite powerfully about the role of imagination. And actually, you put out a little hip-hop single, too. I forget what I remember that as well, come to think of it. But what is the role of the arts when it comes to social activism, struggle, and revolutionary engagement with the world?
Anyway, did I make my point about the preacher? The preacher would say, "How long, O Lord?" But I don't want to keep having to say that, even without the O Lord. I don't want to.
But some preachers say, "How long, O Lord? Lord, I am sent to do something about it."
Okay, there we are.
And we meet in the streets with some revolutionary communists, some anarchists, right, some progressives, and others. But in terms of the arts, though, I wanted to make that clear that we
do have that unity, that we don't want to have to keep saying how long, even if some of us say, "Oh Lord," and some of us don't.
That's right.
That's where we meet, that we don't want to have to keep saying that.
That's exactly.
Now, as for the point about, so I just wanted to make that clear. But as far as the point about the arts, yes, because people, you know, I'll invoke your tradition. People do not live by bread alone.
That's right. That's
you know, people need cultural and intellectual sustenance, as well as material sustenance. And people constantly produce art of one kind or another. The question is, what is going to be the content of that, and what is it going to serve? But also, how do we approach different people within different traditions or different fields of art, whether it's painting or music or other things? How do we understand what they're trying to do, and how do we try to give life to things in such a way that it all can contribute to the building up the basis to actually make a revolution, and then to actually have a new society in which culture and art can flourish on a whole other level in many diverse expressions? There isn't just one form of art that should be promoted, and there isn't just art that's political in the more direct and explicit sense that's important. That kind of art, which calls people, you know, to the barricades, to the political struggle, so to speak, you know, using barricades metaphorically. Now, let's not distort what's being said here.
That's right. Yeah,
you know,
right.
At this point, we're talking about metaphorically, but out in the streets fighting back against the oppression, the art that calls people forward to do that is very important. But there are also many other forms of art, you know, that are more quote-unquote abstract, if you will, or, you know, jazz or other things, which give expression to a mood or a sentiment or a feeling, you know, which also have to be, you know, embraced as part of what we're doing. Now, you know, if they have a reactionary content, if they call on people to do things that are harmful to the masses of people, or they create a mood that depresses people and makes them feel that they can't do anything to change their conditions, then we have to get into some struggle about that and say, no, let's have some art and culture. Let's not, you know, let's have hip-hop, but let's not have hip-hop that talks about bitches. Oh, I don't know.
No, that's all
say
right.
Say that on the radio.
The B-word, that's right. No, that's fine.
Okay, bitches and hoes, you know, and that's right. Puts women down and just says, I'm going to get mine, and I don't care what happens to anybody else, and if I have to step on or even shoot other people to get rich, let's do that, and I'm just going to promote all kinds of backward nonsense. Let's not have that. Let's have more fight to power, and let's have more let's get rid of oppression, not let's get ours out of this oppression. Not let's get in on it, but let's get rid of it. But, you know, so there has to be struggle about art, but also you have to allow art to flourish and develop. You can't, you know, try to squeeze it, squeeze the life out of it. You can't try to take things as soon as they come forth and put some kind of litmus test to them to see if they measure up in some sort of, you know, abstract and dogmatic sense. You have to have a lot of flourishing of art and culture. This is one of the key things of the new synthesis of communism that I've been bringing forward, that we need to give a lot of emphasis to giving life to these different things, and then we can sift through them, and not just a few of us, but masses of people can sift through them to see what it is that actually inspires them toward things that would really be positive. And what is it they need to discard because it actually leads them away from where they need to go? There are a lot of different, you know. Yes, I did produce something all played out.
It was a nice single.
But that was just my giving vent, you know, giving expression, not vent, but giving expression to my outrage at a lot of things that go on that get over here, the hypocrisy of the ruling class of this country, and also the backward stuff among the masses of people, which, yes, does need to be called out. If, you know, we have a saying too, if people are talking, well, I'm going to use the R-rated version here. If people are talking nonsense, you know, they need to be called out for it. Yeah, you know, and that's part of what I was doing there. But, you know, look, I'm not a highly developed, you know, hip hop artist, but there are lots of highly developed hip hop artists. And that's why I say we need more of them doing things that will contribute to the struggle to get rid of oppression in many different forms. It doesn't have to be, let's get rid of oppression, you know, time to stop all the depression. It doesn't have to be like that. But it can be, a lot of different forms in which people, you know, are creating the kind of atmosphere and feeling that inspires people to better things and to stand up and fight back and eventually to make revolution.
No, it's one of the reasons why we talk about Lupe Fiasco and Brother Ali and Eric Badu and some of the other young artists affecting the generation to come, as it were. Two quick questions. One, of course, is the role of the new Jim Crow, the prison industrial complex, and the fact that so many of revolutionary communists I know zero in on the deeply racist and unjust criminal justice system. And prisoners themselves seem to be more and more open to at least a broader analysis of the context in which they find themselves. Is this part of the role of trying to engage in transformation society, zeroing in on the prison industrial complex, making sure, like with Michelle Alexander, we have a public discussion about the new Jim Crow?
Well, yes. Look, first of all, once again, to go to the moral dimension, if you will, this is,
yes,
you know, and the political dimension where they're joined. This is a tremendous outrage. I mean, I think Michelle Alexander has done a tremendous service by systematizing an understanding of what, a huge phenomenon this is and what social role it plays, that this is the new Jim Crow. This is the new segregation and repression directed against black people and also Latinos. But it's part of the whole history of the oppression of black people in this country. And it's an outrage, and it needs to be taken on. There needs to be a massive struggle developed against this in which thousands and ultimately millions of people, and not just black and Latino people, but people everywhere who care about justice and ending injustice, need to become part of this. And from our point of view, we approach this as understanding that this is something very, it gets to something very basic about the whole history of this country and the whole nature of the system in this country, the oppression of black people. And this, so we've taken this up, this new Jim Crow, this mass incarceration. I mean, look what they're doing to the youth. You know, I mean, millions and millions of them being marched off to prison, you know, and being given jackets from the time they're young kids, you know, being rolled up on, stopped and frisked, four or five are hanging out on the street corner in L.A., and they constitute a gang, which therefore is automatically stripped of its rights. You know, if this were going on in any other country, everybody would say, what a horrific country that is that does something like that to a whole section of people, particularly the youth. So this has to be taken on. From our point of view, this gets to the very nature of this system, and it's one of the fundamental reasons why this system needs to be swept aside. And we've also taken up a mass struggle against the degradation of women in some of the main forms in which patriarchal and male supremacist oppression is coming down on women, and in the just rampant and vicious and mainstreaming of pornography that's going on, and sexual violence against women, as well as the attacks, the constant incessant attacks, which people like Obama and others are doing nothing to counter, by the way, against the right of women to reproductive freedom, even to have the right to abortion or even birth control in order to be able to determine whether they themselves are going to have children, and if so, when and under what conditions. So this is another thing that gets, it's a mass outrage. There's not enough awareness of it, and there's not enough struggle around it in both these two things, the mass incarceration and the mass degradation of women in these forms. There is not enough awareness, which we need to go out and change, and there's not the kind of mass struggle that there would be and there should be and would be if people understood what is actually going on and what it really represents. And from our point of view, all this is part of building toward getting rid of this system, because all this is rooted in and fundamental to this system. The oppression of black people and other people of color, the oppression of women, you cannot get rid of that under this system, and we need to be rid of it.
Well, I wish we had 2 hours just to be able to sustain this conversation, because I know, again, the internationalism of your vision of the Revolutionary Communist Party's vision is crucial. So the issues of drones that we highlight, of course, on this show, the bombs dropped on innocent people, connected to the American empire, connected to imperial policies abroad on the one hand, but also, of course, the Wall Street oligarchs still control of the economy here on the other. Question that liberals often ask for the kind of conversation we have, which is, does America have the capacity for the kind of revolution that you're calling for? Wouldn't there first be a fascist revolution before there's a communist revolution? That is to say, there's more right-wing of soil in the country. So if you actually had a clash, it'd be more fascist than communist. And therefore, the liberals say, you better hold on for the middle ground, because we're the only thing standing between poor people and fascism. What do you say to such a
view? Well, I think, on the one hand, that is a real danger.
Yes.
And there
yes.
is a real fascist movement in this country, and it has connections up to the highest levels of government in the Republican Party. It has backing from powerful forces within the ruling class of this country. So that's a real thing and shouldn't be ignored or underestimated. But the answer to it is not to try to, quote-unquote, hold on to the middle ground, because the middle ground keeps getting shifted and dragged more and more to the right, so that the liberals start finding themselves compromising more and more with fascism in order to hold off fascism. And that is a recipe or a formula for disaster. What has to happen is we have to bring forward the force of people who suffer the most under this system and have the most reason to rise up against it, but also other people throughout the middle class and others, including the students, including the people in the intelligentsia, professionals and others, who may not yet be convinced of the need for revolution or may not feel that their life calls out for it in the same urgent way that people on the bottom of this society who catch hell, if you I want to use another metaphor like that, catch hell every day.
That's Malcolm. That's Malcolm X right there.
Right, that is. I openly acknowledge my debt to Malcolm on that one.
Prophetic Muslim. Yeah, no, right here.
Yeah, I openly acknowledge that debt, yes. Catch hell every day under
that's
the
right.
system.
That's
but,
right.
you know, there's also people in the middle class who may not be in that position, but who are outraged by a lot of the injustices and the things you're talking about, the wars, the environmental destruction, the use of the drones, which could kill, hundreds if not thousands of civilians already in countries, on different continents already now. You know, the bombing of Libya, which more people should have been outraged by, the U.S. and NATO bombing of Libya. But, the wars that have continued in Afghanistan and other places, there are many people who are upset about these things. But as long as they hold on to the notion that we better not say a peep about them because we might encourage the fascists, they're just going to allow things to get worse and worse. And then we could find ourselves in a situation where the form of rule over the people takes on an overtly and directly terroristic, fascistic form. But what's going on? Two things. We're not going to stop that by conciliating with it and by trying to rely on other sections of the ruling class, which are not going to resist it in the way it needs to be resisted, because they are representatives of the same system, and they have to work out their compromises with these fascist forces who are also part of the ruling structure. And second of all, the answer to it is revolution. The answer is not trying to preserve this system in some kind of form that would be a little less horrible than fascism.
Mm-hmm. Which groups in American society do you think would be most open to your message of revolutionary change?
Look, we have to look, who are the people that, again, we'll invoke Malcolm, who are the people who are catching hell the hardest in the hardest ways under this system every day? The people, not the in the more bourgeois strata, but the basic masses of people among black people, Latinos, and others in the inner city, and other poor people in the country, and people who have had a better, you know, life, or have had a little bit higher standard of living, maybe unionized workers, who are now being driven down, you know, and losing some of that. But the basic bedrock of revolution, as we say it, are the people who are, you know, have the foot on them the hardest, and who are in conditions of poverty and brutality as a result of the workings of the system and as a result of how the system is enforced over them. Those are the people who have the most fundamental and driving interest in changing things radically, and they just need to be convinced of the possibility of doing that, and that's what we're working to do. And they need to be, have again, they need to have their consciousness transformed to see the full picture of this system and its horrors, not just what it does to them, but what it does to people in all different parts of society, and even worse, to people in other parts of the world, especially what's called the third world. But that's going to be the bedrock and driving force. And then on that basis, we have to go out and unite much broader forces, as I said earlier, among the students, among the intelligentsia more generally, you know, among the middle class, certainly among women who are oppressed under this system, among gay people and others who are oppressed under this system. We have to go out and build what we call a broad united front, but under the leadership of the proletariat, that is the exploited class in this society on whose backs the whole system is built.
Yes, indeed. Negro National Anthem, Lift Every Voice. That is the voice of my dear brother, legendary leftist, legendary lover of poor and oppressed people, legendary chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, Bob Ovakian. Thank you so very much. I hope you have unsettled many in our audience, because we need to hear voices from across the board wrestling with the issues of poverty, militarism, empire, male supremacy, homophobia, anti-Semitism, anti-Arab, anti-Islamic sensibility. Why? Because of a love of humanity. Thank you so very much, my brother.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
You've just been listening to an interview that Cornel West did with Bob Ovakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, back in October of 2012. And it's an interview I wanted to play to highlight what this upcoming dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Ovakian is going to be like. And speaking of the dialogue in New York City on November 15th, Revolution and Religion, the Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, you can get your tickets now. If you live in New York, you can get them at Revolution Books in New York. If you live anywhere that has a Revolution Books store or anywhere near that, you can get your tickets there. And if you don't live in New York City, you can go online to revcom.us and get your tickets right there. All right, real quick, you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op for today, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going out now with Fighting Song from Outer National.